Next item. I have written details of a GRU covert action in Turkey. They propose to supply weapons and explosives to Kurdish separatists in Istanbul. Despite objection from the intelligence services, President Putin last night approved the operation. I have included all the details. So much intel. Your reports will go out tonight, said Walters, stowing the thermos in his backpack. One last thing. Are you aware of the situation with someone called Magnet? Said Dominica. She knew Benford's penchant for compartmentation and did not want to say too much. Walters nodded. Simon Benford briefed me by secure phone when they tapped me to meet you. I know the general facts, as much as any of us knows. I have reported all I have heard, said Dominica, but please emphasize to Benford that Magnet is being looked at for an unspecified job in the administration. The Kremlin is very excited. I still do not know Magnet's identity.
This will create a storm in headquarters, said Ricky.
It will create more than a storm if Magnet begins reading my intelligence reports in his new position and begins feeding them to Moscow, said Dominica. Ricky, for the first time in his young career, saw and appreciated the icy danger this woman, all agents live with every day, and marveled at the courage required to keep operating. He checked the elapsed time counter on the tablet. 15 minutes, I should get going, he said, remembering a last item. Mr. Benford wanted me to ask you for confirmation, when you can, on who was behind the death of our late director, Alex Larson. He's obsessed with finding out. Dominica looked at her shoes. Please tell Simon only the president could have given the order. I suspect Anton Gorelikov would be entrusted to design such a plan. I will confirm when I can. Walters nodded. You'll be talking to Nash in 10 days. Dominica could not shake his hand. She had heard that the FSB had absolutely stopped deploying Metka when its use against Western diplomats became an embarrassing international story in the heady years of Glasnost, but CIA continued the prophylactic protocol nonetheless.
You trust Putin would never start spritzing our asses again? Gable had snorted.
When they saw each other in Vienna, she would ask Nate about any results from using spy dust on Susan. Her Nate, as mad as she had been at him in Athens, she missed him and yearned to see him. She smiled at him. You know your way back? Take care with the thermos, and thank you for the watch and glasses. Walters shrugged on his backpack. Stay safe, Dominica, he said. I'll come out any time, any place, if you need me. I'll be checking the signal sites every day. He turned and disappeared around a bend in the stream bed, stirring the ground fog as he moved. Let one of the 17th-century Tartar ghosts living in the mossy Golosov Ravine speed you safely home, Dominica thought. Benford raved in his office, prompting Dottie, his secretary of 8 years, to shake her head in warning at various CID officers who wished to speak with the chief this morning. Best not, perhaps this afternoon, was the whispered refrain. Dominica's newest tidbit about Magnet's being looked at by the president for a big job should have made sorting the possibles easier, but he needed a name. Benford already suspected and feared the worst. The senior vacancy that the Kremlin was steering Magnet toward was the one the Russians themselves had created by killing his friend Alex Larson, DCIA. He knew he was looking for a senior figure who sometime in the last decade had known enough about the U.S. Navy railgun to have reported technical details to the Russians. The scores of winning Navy personnel, officers, enlisted scientists, and civilian contractors could now, in theory, be whittled down, as none of them was likely to be tapped by the president. Or was it someone they had not thought of? Of the dozen high-ranking bureaucrats, only the current secretary of the Department of Energy had occasionally been briefed on the railgun, but he had spent years in other departments on other projects. According to Dominica, Magnet had been an active reporting source for a decade, an anomaly. Could she have misreported the facts? More ominous, could that slick bastard Anton Gorelikov be parceling variants of the same story to different people, called a barium enema in the game, as a loyalty test to see which variant later surfaced to finger the traitor? In London, MI6 called the barium trap a blue dye test, describing the same mole-catching principle metaphorically as pouring blue dye down a pipe to observe from which downstream outlet the dye would eventually issue.
At a counterintelligence liaison conference in London several years earlier, Benford had declared the British terminology idiotic, pointing out that pipes, especially the decrepit plumbing in the United Kingdom and Europe, became clogged or they broke underground, and that the metaphor of a barium enema was more to his liking. "That, Simon, is because you are an uphill gardener," said C, the chief of six, which slang Benford did not understand, and no one told him it meant sodomite. "Thank God for the special relationship," breathed the Brits in the room. Gable and Forsyth met Benford in the executive dining room at Langley for lunch, where they tossed around ideas and theories. The elegant room, as narrow as the dining car on a train, on the executive seventh floor of headquarters overlooking the tree-lined Potomac River, featured tables placed closely together so that new arrivals were forced to walk between them, nodding to friends or cutting enemies. Everyone saw everyone else, and with whom they were lunching, and the cabals and cliques and gangs among the seniors at Langley were therefore common knowledge. Benford ordered a plate of pasta with anchovies, parsley, pan grattato, and lemon, while Forsyth chose the crab bisque and Gable the grilled shrimp. "This alarms me," said Benford, slurping pasta. "A Russian mole could wind up in the cabinet room." Gable stabbed a shrimp. "What I don't get is that Domi says the fucker's been working for a decade," he said. "That means his previous job was of interest to the Ruskies." "I'm worried it's a trap, a test before Putin gives her the SVR job," said Forsyth. "Christ, we vet our directors before putting them forward. So might the Kremlin." The chief of the Office of Congressional Affairs, Eric Duchin, a galloping careerist, busybody, and gossip, arrived with a posse of his toad-eaters making their way between tables, stopping to greet fellow division chiefs amid great laughter and guffaws. Duchin stopped at Benford's table, surrounded by his grinning acolytes, who were known as the douchebags, on the ops floors. Duchin had a Gumby square head, thick snow-white hair, and a narrow face. Students at the farm had nicknamed him Q-Tip. "Simon," he said, nodding. "Eric," said Benford. Silence. Gable fingered the skewer that his shrimp had been served on. "I'm calling a meeting on Friday," said Duchin, finally. "SSCI, the Senate Select Committee, wants CIA to provide courtesy briefings to the possible nominees for the director's job. Just a heads up to prepare. The committee wants all nominees to be able to discuss current operations during closed hearings, including your Russian antics." Benford put down his fork, choosing to ignore the word antics. "Am I given to understand that operational briefings are to be provided to multiple individuals, only one of whom will eventually be confirmed as CIA director? It's customary to provide a limited briefing to the final nominee, and only to the final nominee." Duchin shrugged. "Your precious secrets will be safe with them," he said. "I'll send you their bio packets. All currently hold SITK, Special Intelligence Talent Keyhole, top secret clearances, including special access program tickets. Besides, the director wants it done this way. Greater transparency." After Alex Larson's drowning, an acting director had been appointed, whom the obsequious Duchin was already calling director. Benford bristled. "Greater transparency. In an intelligence service." He snapped. "Duchin, you are incapable of sentient thought. You are my natural enemy. Go away." Duchin shrugged. "Take it up with the director," he said. "He's committed to a smooth transition. See you Friday." The three sat silently at the table, thinking of a pair of electric blue eyes alone in the Kremlin, flitting across the slack, beefy faces around the table, any one of whom would pull the trigger on her without hesitation. These nominees' briefings necessarily would include, at the least, a mention of a CIA-run penetration of the SVR and, at worst, Diva's true name. Heresy. "How does this work, the possible nominees for director all being briefed and all being interviewed by SSCI?" said Gable. "Whatever happened to POTUS picking his man, one person, and nominating him? What the fuck is this, a beauty pageant?" "The acting director suggested it," said Forsyth. "This way he can push forward different candidates, all of whom will dismantle Alex Larson's policies, placate Congress, and keep the agency focused on the environment instead of the kiloton yield of the uranium device the Nokos detonated underground 2 months ago. Benford shook himself, pushed his plate away, and looked at Forsythe. What did you say before?
The acting director wanted it this way.
No, before that, said Benford.
That we vet our own directors before putting them forward.
Exactly, said Benford, and the Russians had Alex killed, and we're looking for a mole.
Who's going to get a big-ass job in the exec branch, said Gable.
Which vacancy is the director of this agency? It's clear now. The Kremlin's candidate is for DCIA, said Benford, pounding the table.
Forsythe looked at Benford over the top of his glasses.
You better be sure before you pull the fire alarm. Not even Putin could pull this off.
Maybe not, said Benford, but that Gorelikov mastermind could if what Diva says about him is true.
Gable stopped picking his teeth.
You saying one of the three nominees for DCIA is the mole? Could they swing that?
He asked. Maybe yes, maybe no, said Benford, but we can't sit by and do nothing. We have to brief them all before one's confirmed, Forsythe groaned.
Too obvious, said Benford. Let us consider how to pour some blue dye down a pipe.
Gable started picking his teeth again.
If you're talking barium enema, I got a turkey baster in my office.
Benford's Lemon Pasta. Sauté anchovy fillets in olive oil with finely diced leeks until the fillets dissolve and the leeks soften. In a separate pan, toast breadcrumbs with a little olive oil, garlic, and dried red chili flakes until the crumbs, pan grattato, are golden brown. Cook bucatini, drain, and toss with the anchovy oil and leeks. Sprinkle with chopped parsley, breadcrumbs, and a generous squeeze of lemon juice. Serve immediately.
Chapter 14. Expedient Amorality. Diva's handwritten report meticulously documented the Security Council debate in the Kremlin regarding the GRU military covert action in Turkey, encrypted Obvol, put forth by Major Shlikov, who argued that Turkey was in chaotic transition. Fundamentalist Islamic political parties were eroding the secular military Ataturk traditions. The country had since 1984 been struggling with a prolonged low-intensity armed urban insurrection by the Socialist Kurdistan Workers' Party, PKK, in their bid for political rights and self-determination. Current U.S. military aid to the Kurdish Peshmerga in Iraq had discommoded the Turkish government, even though the Iraqi Peshmerga had no political connection to PKK terrorists. Ankara moodily conflated this military support in Iraq with American endorsement of Kurdish desires to secede from the country and to claim a substantial swath of sovereign Turkish territory as their hereditary homeland. Recognizing a developing bilateral schism and subsequent opportunity to drive a wedge between Washington and Ankara, something Putin and his coterie of valets knew how to do best, GRU planners had developed a plan for Turkey. Diva's narrative, printed in Russian in space-saving letters so small that translators had to use magnifying glasses to read the text, reported that the aggressive Shlikov had laid out his plan by which Moscow would supply PKK cells in Istanbul with RPG-18 Mukha anti-armor rockets, MON-200 anti-personnel mines, and larger PMN-4 pressure-fired blast mines for use in urban terror attacks in Istanbul, designed to create a crisis in the government, exacerbate tense relations with Washington, and ultimately to destabilize Turkey, the traditional southern bulwark of NATO. Russian naval special forces would support the operation. The materiel would be delivered in a series of nighttime forays by small boats disguised as fishing vessels to PKK members waiting at a deserted out-of-season picnic grounds on the banks of Riva Creek, 4 navigable miles inland from the Black Sea coast of Turkey. PKK would then truck the weapons into Istanbul, stage them in a number of warehouses, and distribute them among cells. Despite objections to the covert action plan from the civilian intelligence services, President Putin had approved the operation. He was willing to undertake this foreign adventure and run the risks, which the GRU assessed as minimal, to weaken NATO, and especially to destabilize the only Muslim member state of the coalition. After that, no one objected any longer. Diva concluded her report by writing of Shlikov, "This golden youth intends to provide enough explosives to PKK to set Istanbul ablaze on both sides of the Bosphorus, from Europe to Asia. Diva's reporting triggered a hasty meeting in CIA headquarters in Langley. Benford recently had designated Gable as Diva's primary handler. Benford, Forsyth, Gable. These three veteran officers were as different in temperament and style as imaginable, but they had come together as a team when Nate Nash recruited Diva in Helsinki, and under their subtle tutelage, she had developed into a world-class reporting source. Nash, the fourth and most junior member of the coterie, was absent from this meeting. He had recently been posted as chief of operations in CIA's London station. On the face of it, a plum assignment in a solidly advancing career, but really designed to keep him busy and away from Diva. Forsyth, arguably the best case officer among them, had called Nash a magician on the street, working against hostile surveillance in denied areas. Forsyth had been Nate's chief of station twice before, and he knew what a good officer he was despite the sex with Diva problem. I seem to remember your unapproved infatuation 20 years ago with a certain safe house keeper in Rome, Forsyth had once reminded Gable while discussing Nash. You knew it was against the rules, but you used to run over there bow-legged to see her every week. That was different, growled Gable. We were young, she used to cook carbonara for me, and I was helping her out. Forsyth looked at him deadpan. Carbonara? Did she use pancetta, guanciale, or some other pork product? Very funny. If it was such a big fucking deal, why didn't you kick me in the balls? Said Gable, red-faced. Maybe I knew you could handle it, or maybe I knew you had the discipline to keep her safe, said Forsyth. Like, maybe we give Nash the same slack. I'm not saying he's a choir boy, but Domi's half to blame. God damn it, they're in love with each other. You said so yourself. Gable shook his head, but agreed. Today, Forsyth had included Lucius Westfall, who, as Benford's new assistant, was cleared for Diva material, and thus was on the very small bigot list for the case, the abbreviated roster of officers who had been read into her file, and who were cleared for the RH, Restricted Handling, compartment. Westfall sat quietly in a chair in the corner. He knew his place on the food chain in this room. The facility these Russians have for mayhem is awe-inspiring, said Forsyth. He looked up from Diva's reports about Istanbul and pushed his half-moon glasses to the top of his head. They're fuckers, said Gable. But we take this to Turkish liaison and help them, they're going to kiss our asses for a decade. I agree, said Forsyth, but not to TNIO, the intel guys. They don't trust us. We take it to the TNP, Turkish National Police. They're serious and accessible. And when you say help them, said Benford, turning to Gable, you mean exactly what? Interdict the shipments, wrap up the gomers waiting in the swamp for the delivery, let the TNP sweat them, and clean out the rest of the cells, said Gable. Lucius Westfall cleared his throat and scraped his chair. Gable looked over at him. He liked the young guy, but as with Gable's protege, Nate, he would never say so. You have something to say, say it, said Gable. Don't keep us squeezing our legs together. I was thinking, said Lucius, Istanbul's population is over 14 million. The Kurds in the city number about 4 million. Admirable command of the facts, which I trust will soon be shown to be relevant to this discussion, said Benford, rubbing his face. The point is that we'll never be sure of taking out 100% of the PKK cells with a couple of raids and a score of arrests, said Westfall, swallowing. The city's too big, the Kurdish population is too diffuse. We have to consider this in three parts. Tell us, said Benford. He liked linear thinking, which he frequently raved was uniformly absent in the U.S. government. We have to interdict all the Russian materiel without exception, said Lucius. We can't let even one mine get through. We then have to identify as completely as possible the PKK organization in the city. Finally, we have to neutralize the source of the problem, GRU Major Valery Shlikov. The men in the room shifted in their seats. Well, you're a regular Alfred Einstein, said Gable. Keep going. For all his gruffness, Gable knew how to draw young officers out, make them think, stick up for what they believed. To stop the whole thing, I think we have to beacon the weapons before they get to Turkey, said Westfall. That way we track them from Inland Creek to warehouse to backyard potting shed to safe house cellar, so we get them all.
Before they get the turkey, said Gable. As in Russia? The others were quiet, thinking the same thing.
Out of the question, said Benford. Diva's already in jeopardy as it is, reporting this unique intelligence. We fuck up in Istanbul, she's one of 20 council members in the room, not even a full member yet, who know about the PKK covert action. Trying something with the shipment when it's still in Russia would be doubly suicidal for her.
Maybe not, said Westfall.
Diva told us the crates were going to be trucked to Sevastopol and staged in a warehouse, then ferried across the Black Sea to Turkey in small fishing boats when they get the green light from Shlikov. It's a GRU covert action. They'll keep this quiet and they'll stay away from official Russian naval installations. It'll be a commercial warehouse, an easy target.
Okay, Hotshot, you take the responsibility for invading Russia and starting World War III, said Gable.
Westfall kept quiet.
Benford got up from the couch and started pacing, looking at Westfall sideways.
How would you propose to break undetected into a warehouse in Russian-controlled Sevastopol and install beacons on a dozen crates, he said.
We could use the Wolverines, said Westfall.
Heads around the room came up.
Ain't they all retired? Said Gable.
They're on reserve status, said Forsyth. They didn't like to be sidelined. I kept them busy for as long as I could.
I heard they were pretty effective, said Westfall. The file's fascinating.
Cold War throwbacks, said Benford, head cocked to the side, thinking.
Forget it, said Gable. They were crazy, anti-commie Polacks, out of control. Who's going to handle them?
We need a Russian speaker, strong operator, denied area expert, said Westfall.
Everybody was thinking the same name.
And who, pray tell, might that be? Said Benford.
Nate Nash, said Westfall.
No one said anything. Westfall didn't know about Nash's penalty box status.
Put that aside for now, said Forsyth. What do we do with Shlikov?
I've been thinking about that, said Westfall, swallowing. Diva says Gorelikov wants to sink Shlikov. What if we give him a reason to do it, make it appear that Shlikov himself is responsible for the collapse of the entire covert action in Istanbul?
Keep going, said Gable.
All three seniors were listening hard now.
I believe you ops officers call it burning someone, said Westfall. What if we make it look like Shlikov is double-dipping, taking money from CIA and not reporting it? The Russians are so suspicious, they'll believe it.
Tall order.
It would have to be convincing, said Forsyth, already calculating. Bank account, spy gear under the mattress, signals.
It really doesn't have to be 100% convincing, said Westfall.
Diva and Gorelikov will have enough to ruin him. Implicating and convicting innocent people are Russian art forms.
And the lead investigator gets credit for catching a rat, said Forsyth.
A blue-eyed chief of Line KR, said Gable. It protects her and gives her another CI scalp.
It's still a risk. Shlikov is supposed to be very good and popular, said Benford, looking around the room.
They were thinking of the same name again.
I'll call London, said Forsyth. He can be here in 2 days.
I want to see him personally, said Benford.
We all should reconvene when he gets here.
If we're going to unseat this GRU ruffian, Nash must be brilliant about it.
Benford stopped pacing. Tell Nash specifically from me that Benford says he should endeavor to be brilliant.
And I'll send the reactivation call out to the Wolverines, said Forsyth.
They'll be pleased.
Pleased? Snorted Gable. Who's gonna tell him Stalin died?
Westfall swallowed twice.
Nate walked into Benford's office at noon of the second day, having taken the early morning flight from London. The cable from Chief EUR Forsyth recalling him to headquarters had mentioned only that he was required for consultations, which in the patois of Kabliz could mean he was in trouble for an unknown transgression, or had been chosen as the sacrificial goat for assignment to a liaison billet and Phoebe headquarters, a nightmare exile that no ops officer wanted. Or there was a spectacular operation that Benford wanted him to handle. Nate, the case officer, studied Benford's French bulldog face for a clue, but the mole hunter was inscrutable. Benford pointed to a chair beside his littered desk. His whole office looked like Pompeii after Vesuvius.
opened a restricted handling file and read silently. Like any astute operator, Nate read the block letter title upside down on the RH title page. GC Diva. What was this? Were they going to discipline him over the spat he'd had with Dominica in Athens? That was weeks ago. Nate knew his stock with Benford, Gable, and Forsyth had taken a hit over the years since Helsinki because of his relationship with Diva. He also knew very well that he had not been summarily separated from the service only as an accommodation to keep the agent in harness. As it was, he was hanging by a thread. Nate's mind raced back to the beginning. The hiatus in contact with Dominica between meetings in Europe always cooled things down, but these officers were not dummies. Benford expected recidivism. Forsyth ruefully understood him. Gable was the worst. He knew both Nate and Dominica as protégés, could read them like the carny who guesses your weight at the country fair. Worse, he could smell coitus from across the room. The tear-filled and disastrous conclusion to the contact in Athens had not helped. Nate fretted over the futility and unprofessionalism of their love affair. It was bezperspektivniak, a hopeless situation, a fruitless exercise. Dominica loved him passionately and didn't care about the rules. Dominica would tease him for acting like a dour Russian while she soared like a liberated American love child. The issue of her defection and resettlement was the tinder that always started the arguments. How do you feel about her now? He thought to himself, thankful that among Benford's other vampiric skills, mind-reading was probably not numbered. That was fortunate, since Nathaniel Nash, at this minute, knew, had always known that he loved the beautiful Russian with the serious scowl that would melt into a dizzying smile from across the street when she saw him approach. He loved the way she breathed his name, Nate, with the broad Russian vowel, when they made love and how her head went back, eyelids fluttering and chin trembling, groaning, «Я заканчиваю», «I'm finishing». Russians never say I'm coming in bed. The bubble popped when Benford looked up and spoke. Are you jet-lagging now, Nash? No, Simon, I'm fine. It's an easy flight, said Nate, trying to blot out the image of Dominica's face on the pillow. We have something in mind for you, something rather important, said Benford. Just don't tell me I should buy a 12-month meal plan for the cafeteria at the J. Edgar Hoover building. Nate had meant this as a joke to establish bonhomie and corporately to suggest or plead that he mustn't be sent over to the FBI to work on the joint task force. Joking with Benford was like lion hunting on horseback with a spear. You could in theory do it, but odds were it would not turn out well. Benford stared at Nate for 10 seconds. Do you know anything about science, Nash? Benford asked. I mean, apart from the fluid mechanics of nocturnal emissions, of which I am sure you are a long-time student. Nate shrugged, already regretting his joke. Since light travels faster than sound, some people appear bright until you hear them speak, said Benford. Endeavor not to be one of those people. A good place to start is not to speak unless spoken to. Okay, Simon, said Nate. Now, we have a critical operation ahead of us. It's rather complicated as it's in three parts. Alarming as it may be, you would have an axial role in each part. Nate opened his mouth to ask a question, but Benford put up his hand and shook his head in a "don't spoil it" look of distaste. If you would permit me to summarize, said Benford. He sat back in his chair and propped his stocking feet on his desk, starting a minor avalanche of papers that fluttered to the floor. Diva just reported that the Kremlin seeks to destabilize Turkey by supplying anti-armor rockets and pressure mines to separatist PKK insurgents in Istanbul. Part 1. We will beacon the weapons crates at their staging point in Sevastopol using an experienced raiding team of reservists that, considering your Russian language and denied area experience, you will lead. The operation should take no longer than 2 days, with time on target approximately 2 hours. Reservists from Desert Storm or Afghanistan, said Nate. No, closer to the years of the Berlin Wall, said Benford. I beg your pardon, said Nate. Berlin Wall? The Berlin Wall, said Benford. Perhaps you missed it while watching Dance Fever on television.
Dance Fever, said Nate.
Never mind. There is no reason for you to have heard of them, the Wolverines. They distinguished themselves during the Cold War in Poland.
Distinguished themselves how? Said Nate, like they blew things up?
Benford waved his hand in the air. Let me continue, he said. Part two. You will liaise with the Turkish National Police as they prepare counter-terror raids against PKK, informed by our beacon tracking of the materiel. Those preparations include tell-taps on the phones of the SVR Istanbul Residentura and GRU Major Valery Shlikov, who is the on-the-ground Russian intel officer supporting PKK cells, which is why we again need your Russian. Part 3. Simultaneously, we need to burn Comrade Shlikov. One idea is to make it look like he is a CIA asset and to suggest he subverted his own covert action. We think this idea has merit, but the plan is unformed. I want you to think about it. A feature of this final act is for Diva herself to investigate, expose, and defame Shlikov, which will protect her as the source, as well as bestow additional counterespionage credit on her as chief of Lion KR.
You anticipate personal meetings with her in Istanbul? Said Nate nonchalantly.
We'll be able... Marty Gable is primary handler, said Benford. You can participate in meetings, but I want you to be smart to exercise restraint.
Nate looked down at his hands.
Restraint. I trust I'm clear, said Benford.
Yes, sir, said Nate.
You know I would never jeopardize her security. I mean that.
Benford's face moved.
I for one remember it was you, a young case officer just expelled short of tour from Moscow by that damp squib Gondorf, who recruited Diva. It was a signal achievement. She has developed into a source surpassing Cold War stars like Penkovsky and Polyakov and even Korchnoi in the modern age.
Nate felt hot in the face. Benford never complimented anyone.
All the more reason to preserve the case and protect her for as long as we can, said Benford.
And then get her out and resettle her somewhere safe, said Nate.
Perhaps, said Benford, if she at some time wants to defect.
But she won't. And unless she wants out, this service runs her as long as we can, to preserve the intel stream until it stops.
Nate searched Benford's face.
You mean until she's caught and executed, said Nate flatly.
Don't be dramatic, said Benford, sitting up and leaning forward. We all do everything to protect her.
But we keep the intel flowing, is what you're saying, said Nate. Above all else, even her life, down to the last report.
If necessary, yes, to safeguard national security and to preserve the Republic, if you'll forgive the Fustian. It is what we do.
She committed to us. She's risking her life for us, said Nate, getting out of his chair. I'll huddle with Gable about everything and get back to you with details.
He walked to the door, hand on the doorknob, when Benford spoke. Nash, we operate in a hostile fog bank. We deal with ambiguity, and if we must, we apply expedient amorality to accomplish moral goals. Embrace it, or tell me what else you want to do with your life.
Gable's Safe House Carbonara. Sauté lardons of guanciale until chewy crisp. Whisk egg yolks and grated pecorino romano together to form a hard ball. Cook the pasta 1 minute less than al dente, then use pasta water to whisk egg and cheese ball until creamy. Toss cooked pasta with guanciale and egg mixture and serve immediately.
Chapter 15. The Second Cold War. Diva's request that Nash participate in the second meeting with her North Korean nuclear recruitment did not please Benford, who wanted Gable to handle it. But Ricky Walters in Moscow reported that Dominica had insisted Nash specifically be there, which was only going to last a couple of hurried hours, the cottage being so close to IAEA headquarters and the prying eyes of NOCO security guerrillas. Benford relented, reasoning they would not have time in 2 hours to squabble over exfiltration, much less be able to engage, in Gable's words, in any gasp and grunt. Nate flew direct to Copenhagen and took the 2-hour flight to Vienna on Austrian Air, then booked a room at the Pension Domizil,
half a block down Schulerstrasse from Dominica's hotel. He left a note with his room number for her and had breakfast in the curtained dining room. She walked in just as he was finishing. She was elegant in a black skirt, leather tunic with a narrow fur collar, and black leather ankle boots. It had been 3 weeks since Greece, and as was usually the case between them, sweet absence dulled the acrimony over her determination to keep spying despite the mounting dangers. She didn't want any breakfast and looked at her Line T encrypted ops phone repeatedly for text from Ioana, who was waiting at the cottage safe house in case Professor Ri arrived before his scheduled 1200 meeting. They would have 2 hours with him, the entirety of an extended lunch break, which the 5,000 pampered Euro bureaucrats working in the Vienna International Center in Donaustadt, north of the river, were accustomed to. The complex of glittering Y-shaped buildings was permanent home to an alphabet soup of UN offices, from which phalanxes of International Jackson Office churned out hectares of documents, all of which were without doubt critical to the continued survival of the planet. IAEA, Atomic Energy, UNIDO, Industrial Development, UNODC, Drugs and Crime, and UNOOSA, Outer Space Affairs. Dominica checked her phone again, then leaned over the table, grabbed Nate's sweater, and pulled him close to kiss him. Our agent isn't arriving for 2 hours, and it takes 7 minutes to get there on the number 8 tram, she said, sitting back down. I would therefore like to go upstairs to your room and bump bones. Her previous caller from the safe house spat thankfully eclipsed. Nate relaxed and sat back. We normally say jump your bones to describe what you're thinking. Why, said Dominica, I would think bumping describes what I'm thinking more accurately. Upstairs, Nate barely had time to hang the Bitte nicht stören sign on the doorknob and close the door. Dominica's leather-faced tunic squeaked as they made love fully clothed in an armchair, mouths plastered together and Dominica's hair fallen down around her shoulders, tendrils stuck to her sweaty cheeks. A second round consisted of a frantic shedding of clothes, the yanking of the extravagant Austrian eiderdown off the bed, and the reinvention of what historians first called the missionary position, but without any of the original evangelical restraint. They sat on separate seats across from each other on the tram, with trembling sewing machine legs and flushed faces, trying not to look at each other. Dominica's hair had been restored to order, but an errant strand hanging down one side of her face hinted at recent maidenly debauchery. Off the tram, they walked through the garden of the Arkatel, and on the footpath around the reedy Kaiserwasser Lake and down the last stretch of Laberweg, a leafy road that ran along a spit of land fronting the upper Danube, a placid branch of the river that rejoined the main river farther downstream. The houses were all cute two-room summer cottages with red or blue ornamental shutters and screened porches. The cottages had grassy front yards that ran down to the shore, each with a pontoon dock for summer canoes and skiffs, now bare and rocking gently in the slow-moving winter water. It was just 1200, and Professor Ri would appear in a few minutes from now. Nate would play a subordinate role during the debriefing, asking CIA intel requirements at appropriate times. Ioana would take a walk during the meeting, standard procedure, but also convenient in that Dominica wouldn't have to explain who Nate was, at least not right away. Dominica had been toying with the idea of recruiting Ioana for CIA. She would adore Bratok, she knew. The notion of a sub-agent, a Confederate, helping her in this work was something she wanted to discuss with Benford. She was sure it would work, especially if Ioana graduated from Sparrow status to operations. When she opened the cottage door, she knew the world had caved in. The little living room was a mass of splintered furniture and fallen bookcases, including an overturned, blood-soaked armchair that had been slashed a dozen times, its stuffing scattered over the floor. The galley kitchen was ankle-deep in broken plates and glasses. Nate silently motioned to the door, indicating that they should get the hell out, but Dominica shook her head and whispered, "Ioana." Stepping over detritus in the living room, they checked each of the tiny bedrooms. In one, Ioana's clothes were strewn across the bed and a bedside lamp had been thrown in a corner and smashed. Dominica's face was white. They found Professor Ri face down in the tub in the bathroom, remnants of the 5 liters of his blood slick along the tub walls, most of it already down the drain and likely feeding the Danube carp. They went back out into the living room, Dominika's face a grim mask.
This was Shlikov. He just terminated my North Korean case.
Nate kept looking around, listening for footsteps.
Shlikov did this? He said.
No, said Dominika. This is the work of his Spetsnaz bulldog, a man named Blokin, who killed Rapina in New York.
Where's your girl? Said Nate. Wasn't she here waiting for your agent?
I don't know, said Dominika. I'm worried.
She snapped her fingers.
The recorder.
She went to the sideboard cabinet, it had not been touched, and took out the wire recorder Ioana had installed in anticipation of the debriefing. She plugged it into a wall socket, rewound it, and punched play. Nothing but the hiss of dead air.
It's voice activated, said Dominika. She would have put it in standby mode before re-arrived.
The hissing stopped and Dominika froze, staring at the spools. The 2 concealed wireless mics had picked up muffled conversation. Loken's voice suddenly came through clearly, speaking English. So the bastard spoke English all this time, concealing it, thought Dominika. His voice was quiet and silky, then Ioana's voice angry and indignant. Then Blokin switched to Russian, harsh and brutal, followed by the cacophony of a struggle. Ioana was strong and lithe, and it went on for some time, the sound of her ragged breath first faint, then loud as she moved away from or toward the microphones. There was the constant sound of breaking furniture. Dominika looked imploringly at Nate, then back at the recorder, as Ioana cried an abrupt, "Nyet!" followed by a groan, then silence, then moaning, and Bloken's silky voice again in English asking when the Asian gentleman was expected, and what Igorova be coming with him, and Ioana's voice spitting in obscenity. The sound of a slap, then a heartrending scream, quickly muffled, and Ioana woodenly droning that the meeting was postponed, Igorova wasn't even in the city, and another scream. What was he doing to her? Was she tied in a chair? And then a faint knocking at the front door and Bloken's voice moving away, then disappearing altogether, until a man's high-pitched wail was faintly heard, while Bloken did in the bathtub whatever he had decided for the North Korean. While he was out of the room, Ioana, breathing heavily, spoke to the concealed microphone in an urgent, trembling whisper. Her voice was tinny and hung in the air.
"He is a Russian, 60 years old, 68 centimeters, 90 kilos. Fleshy, faceless scar tissue across his forehead, thick arms, very strong. I cut his cheek with a glass, but it did not cost him a step."
Ioana started crying briefly, then stopped and sniffed.
"I think he broke my wrist. He has tied my wrists and ankles, and he is using the edge of a broken dish between my legs."
Dominika, eyes streaming, looked at Nate in horror. Ioana knew she was going to die, yet she was leaving a message for Dominika.
"He is asking for you when you will arrive. I have told him you are not coming, but he does not believe me. He intends to kill you, too. I'm praying you are not on your way. When it starts again, I will scream my head off. Maybe you will hear. Perhaps he will flee. My broken wrist is bent sideways. Wait. I hear screaming from the bathroom. Your scientist is gone. I'm next. He is coming back. Kill him if you can. La tebia liubiu. I love you. Take care. Skumpo, sweetie."
Dominika put her head in her hands and sobbed. Bloken's voice came back in range of the mic, again cooing to Ioana about when Dominika was expected, perhaps not before Ioana had softened the professor up with this pretty little thing between her legs, and another nightmare scream that subsided into a sob, and Ioana slurring over and over that Igorova was not coming. Then she began screaming. Bellows from the pit of her stomach over and over, and her screaming was suddenly cut short, followed by awful gurgling and gasping. Nate recognized the sound of someone drowning in her own blood from a slashed throat. Then a grunt from Bloken as if he had slung her over his shoulder, then the sound of squeaky screen door hinges. Several minutes of silence, then Bloken was back inside, followed by 3 solid minutes of the sounds of him smashing everything in the cottage not already broken, then the front door slamming, and nothing else but the hiss of the recorder. Dominika pointed to the overturned armchair, the seat cushion sodden with blood.
Ioana had died there. Nate walked to the screen door facing the yard and the river and pushed it lightly with a finger. It squeaked like on the tape. Blokin had carried her outside. She was in the river floating downstream to Budapest if she hadn't already fetched up in the crook of a floating log. Nate stopped Dominika, red-eyed and teeth-bared, from going outside.
"Stop," said Nate. "He could be out there. Let me check."
The yard was empty, but there were drops of blood on the pontoon dock where Blokin had walked out to reach deeper water and dumped her in. Nate walked to the end of the dock holding his breath, half expecting to see her staring up at him from the blue-black water under the pontoon floats. Nothing underwater and nothing farther out in the current. The Alta Donau tributary flowed steadily to join the main branch of the Danube several hundred meters south, and there was more than an even chance her body would be seen bumping through the pilasters of the A-22 overpass or another downstream bridge, unless he had wired something heavy around her feet, in which case she would come up in the spring, bleached and swollen, an unidentifiable Jane Doe to confound Austrian authorities until she ended up in the communal section of Zentralfriedhof Cemetery, another sparrow who finished up away from her home, unclaimed by the country she served, her fate and grave unknown to her family. Nate heard Dominika coming up behind him. He caught her and steered her off the tipsy dock, and she looked out at the black winter water, screamed and bent over, and vomited on the grass. He led her back inside, splashed her face with water, pocketed the spool of wire from the recorder, rummaged around Ioana's bedroom and retrieved her Romanian alias passport. They both knew there could be no thought of tipping the police. Professor Ree would be reported missing, but God knows how long it would be before they found him in a rental cottage on the river. Austrian state police forensics were exceedingly thorough. As he closed the front door of the cottage, Nate wiped the doorknob, thinking that between the tub, the furniture, the dishes, and dredging the river bottom under the dock, the owner would have a little spring cleaning to do before the summer rental season began. They walked back down Labutvek, the way they had come, Dominika's cheeks wet with tears. As they walked, Nate half-watched for Blokin to emerge out of the Kaiserwasser in an explosion of foam, like a Nile crocodile ambushing a baby gazelle. But Nate was pretty sure Blokin would already be halfway to Schwehart and the airport. He had knocked off Dominika's agent per instructions, had slaughtered the safe house keeper as a bonus, but had not waited for Igorova, probably because she had been designated a target of opportunity. Take her if you can, but don't loiter on target and don't get arrested. Ioana's screams had hurried him on his way. Their late arrival and the North Koreans' early appearance at the cottage probably saved their lives. Nate had no illusions about being able to fend Blokin off in hand-to-hand combat. Nate was shocked at the brutality of the Spetsnaz killer. He must be quite the lad. All those guys were hard cases, but this one had a screw loose. It was obvious now that Dominika was a target and in danger. Could her new Kremlin patrons protect her? Inside the palace, sure, but on the street? Opposition party leader Nemtsov had been shot on the busy Bolshoi Moskvoretsky Bridge, in the very shadow of the Kremlin's Vodozvodnaya Tower. One thing was for sure, Dominika was dead unless CIA could take out this Shlikov asshole and his dancing bear Blokin. Dominika sagged against him, her body trembling and voice shaking.
"We were in your room making love, while she was being tortured, stalling for time, giving herself to save me," she sobbed. She had the courage to describe the man who was torturing her, even though she knew she was going to die. "O neshatsky, Ioana, poor ill-fated sister. We should have been there."
"We didn't know, and if we had been there, we'd be in the river too," said Nate. "That guy wasn't going to let anyone walk away."
"I should have been there," said Dominika.
Nate stopped in the middle of the pathway and shook her by the shoulders. "Listen to me. Not your fault. A little less guilt and a lot more thinking about surviving. Will this Shlikov take a whack at you in Moscow?" Dominika shrugged and shook him off.
"In the Rudina, anything can happen."
"Then fucking him up in Istanbul is critical. Will you be able to finish him if we can complicate his life?"
"If he fails and embarrasses the president, he is lost. But what will you do?"
"You wouldn't believe me if I told you," said Nate.
As they walked, he outlined the plan to burn Major Shlikov and her part in the operation. She stopped crying, her eyes blazed, and she thought of Ioana. In Washington, the ponderous process of selecting a new DCIA heated up, and Langley was told to prepare for briefings for the candidates' use during congressional testimony. Benford contemplated this requirement with unease. The only policy position of the president that preoccupied Benford was the former's oft-stated distrust of CIA and the president's conviction that it was an anachronistic organization, organically prone to misdeeds and illegal acts, and consequently overdue for demolition and a thorough reorganization. Happily, said the president, a new DCIA would begin critical reforms. To this end, the White House was putting forward three candidates for DCIA, one of whom would be selected by his staff for Senate confirmation. The unsympathetic SSCI approved the plan and ordered CIA to brief the three candidates equally in preparation for confirmation hearings. Briefing sources and methods to candidates before a formal nominee had been selected was heresy, but both the sitting director and the congressional bootlicker Duchin saw to it that division chiefs complied. Benford sat at the end of the massive oval conference table on the seventh floor of headquarters, sourly listening to Forsyth finish briefing the three nominees for DCIA on a sensitive Europe Division asset, the representative of the Palestinian Authority to the International Court of Justice in The Hague, which case was producing voluminous intelligence on Iranian support to the PLO and Hezbollah. Forsyth's presentation had been preceded by a briefing from Chief of Latin America Division, the garrulous Johnny Cross, with a pencil mustache and as handsome as a matinee idol, on a case in Caracas, the recruited Deputy Minister of Petroleum, who had developed into a gold mine of information on the moribund Venezuelan petrochemical industry, including secret payments in the billions from China to keep the spavined government afloat. Next up was Chief of East Asia Division Brenda Neff, blonde, busty, and profane, who would tell the nominees about an EA asset, a captain in the Philippine Navy who was providing useful assessments and imagery of the fortified atolls in the South China Sea being constructed by Beijing. Benford Riley noted that his colleagues were briefing on important but mid-level assets. No division chief was going to totally lift his or her skirt and give up any crown jewels, at least not yet. Duchin knew enough to suspect they were slow rolling, and when the acting director heard, as he certainly would from that woodpecker Duchin, the chiefs would be ordered to open the books to the nominees completely. Only a matter of time. The three nominees sat at the opposite far end of the table, respectively bored, attentive, and mystified. U.S. Senator Celia Feigenbaum was seething. Based on her many years on the Senate Appropriations Committee, she was utterly convinced that duplicitous CIA needed to be radically downsized, if not abolished, commencing with the ceding of various directorates to the DOD, the NSA, and the FBI. If confirmed as DCIA, she was determined to clean house, and to Benford, this was a calamitous notion, made trebly astounding by the senator's expressed view that the abiding clandestine tenets of the agency, stealing secrets and exploiting vulnerabilities to suborn human targets, were immoral. "It's not who we are, it's not what America stands for," purred the senator frequently and piously to any reporter who thrust a microphone in her face. She was a leading contender, in part because her Pecksniffian views mirrored the president's. The senator had arrived with her senior staff director, Robert Farbison, and she blithely demanded he receive the same briefings as the nominees, to which Congressional Affairs Chief Duchin immediately agreed, seeing as how Rob also had TS clearances. Benford gritted his teeth. It was an outrageous concession. He knew all about Farbison. He'd been a fixture in Washington for decades, flitting from staff to staff, wreaking havoc with his revanchist fevers and partisan distemper. Short and squat with a lopsided mouth and capped teeth beneath a hedge-apple nose, Farbison triumphantly sat down at the conference table to listen to the cherished secrets from the vaults of the detested CIA. He turned to notice for the first time that Simon Benford was sitting next to him, made a face of great distaste, got up, and moved 3 seats away, as if Benford were patient zero in a plague ward. The measure of the man, thought Benford, is the distance of 3 seats at the table. More attentive was the U.S. Navy Vice Admiral Audrey Rowland. Trim in her service dress, dark blue uniform, she sat with hands folded on the table, the thick gold sleeve stripes of her 3-star rank resplendent against the dark walnut conference table. She had been named Distinguished Student after advanced studies at the Industrial College of the Armed Forces at Fort McNair in Washington. During the next 20 years, she'd held increasingly more important positions, most recently as commander of the Office of Naval Research on the shores of the Potomac River in Virginia. At ONR, she energetically supervised nearly 3,000 scientists, permanent civilian researchers and contractors, while managing an annual research budget of more than $1 billion. Audrey had risen meteorically, passing through flag ranks of rear admiral, bottom half, to rear admiral in 2 years, and 3 years later her 3rd star as vice admiral was awarded. Benford watched her through lowered lashes, noting that she wore more fruit salad on her chest than Bull Halsey, including the Defense Superior Service Medal, the Legion of Merit, the Defense Meritorious Service Medal, the Meritorious Service Medal, 3 awards, the Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medal, 4 awards, and the Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medal. None was an award for combat or sea duty. At 49 years old, Vice Admiral Audrey Rowland was the modern, empowered woman of the 21st century U.S. Navy. Brilliant, an able administrator, and decorous. She had never married. The inevitable gossip occasionally floated around, mainly among envious male peers who were still lowly captains commanding destroyer groups out of Yokosuka. But VADM Rowland otherwise was discreetly considered a benign maiden, totally dedicated to the Navy and its mission. When the call went out for prospective nominees for DCIA, Rowland's name was immediately proposed by the Chief of Naval Operations, the Secretary of the Navy, and seconded by POTUS. There was precedent. An admiral had helmed CIA in the mid-70s. It was too long ago to remember the lasting damage caused by that Dürr interloper's so-called Halloween massacre in 1977, when 200 operations officers were fired as non-essential, followed by another 800 case officers through 1979, uprooting in one stroke an entire generation of experienced street veterans, most with near-native language skills, a priceless commodity. But that was 30 years ago, and today the Navy would be tickled to have one of its own again running CIA, none of whose ops officers ever showed much respect to Naval Intelligence or NCIS, the Criminal Investigative Service. Benford studied the admiral's long, mannish face, jutting chin, and salt-and-pepper hair pulled into a braided bun in back, but with a poofy prairie wife curl in the front that, even to Benford's blind fashion eye, was bizarre. Rowland noticed Benford looking at her, nodded across the table, and smiled pleasantly, flashing a protruding left incisor. Okay, maybe physicist admirals don't have to be lovely-looking, especially not the brainy ones, he thought. As DCIA, she predictably would focus on the science and technology side of the house, but with luck, she'd at least support a clandestine service in dire need of resuscitation. At the far curve of the table, clearly mystified by at least 2/3 of what had been briefed so far, sat the 3rd nominee for DCIA, Ambassador Thomas Tommy Vano, who had starred as a B-film actor in the 1980s, Space Rage, Maniac, Brainiac, and was voted Sexiest Man Alive in 1985, but started fading and got out of Hollywood before he permanently crashed and burned. Using modest earnings from the movies, he began buying strip malls in Florida, together with an entrepreneur brother-in-law, at the start of the 90s real estate boom. More lucky than prescient, Vano made millions, then formed a company, a consortium of investors buying global commodities, including rare and precious metals. Over the next 2 decades, he followed his partner's leads and made additional millions, several of which he donated to the Right Campaign, and in 2008 was named ambassador to Spain. He stayed for 4 years in a perpetual, if pleasant, state of mild bewilderment, where he first encountered and was transported by the wines of Rioja and Caparones, the earthly Riojan stew of white beans and smoky pimenton pepper. Inexplicably retained by the State Department after his return from Madrid, he became ambassador at large for intelligence, which meant he had a shabby office in an interior corridor at Main State with a two-person staff and attended